I'm going to discuss what happened with Social Security reform in 2005, or maybe a better description would be what didn't happen with Social Security reform in 2005. To start out the year, President Bush separated two issues, privatization and viability. Privatization, or partial privatization, meant taking some of the money that you now pay in Social Security taxes, and instead of having that pass through the government to pay Social Security benefits, have that be put into a personal account, something analogous to what's called a 401k plan, where a person has money that stays in the account until retirement and is invested in mutual funds. So that was half of Bush's proposal. Maybe the key half was this partial privatization, where you would, instead of paying your entire Social Security tax, have part of your Social Security tax be a savings account. So it would be converting some of the current Social Security tax and transfer mechanism into a forced saving account where you can keep the money yourself, but you have to save it. You can't spend it right away. The other issue, other than privatization, was to do something about the long-term viability, the fact that as we move forward and as the baby boomers retire and as we get into an era of greater longevity and fewer children, excuse me, the viability of the system is threatened because the ratio of workers to retirees is falling, and so there are more beneficiaries and fewer taxpayers to support them. So that's the viability issue, and President Bush separated them. Now, some of the initial proponents of privatization did not separate them. They made up this free lunch idea, which I've talked about before, that somehow the stock market is going to grow so fast that you don't have to, that if you privatize, you don't have to worry about viability. Had President Bush not separated those, the proponents of that free lunch view argued that it would make it an easier sell politically. The opponents of that free lunch view were, mostly economists like myself who didn't want to make an argument that we couldn't believe. So in the end, President Bush agreed to go along with the economists and not try to pretend that privatization would by itself solve viability. So he mentally separated the two issues, although he combined the two in his proposal. So he sold privatization not as so much as a way to improve the viability of the system, but as a way of creating what he called the ownership society. The idea of the ownership society is that people would, by having their own accounts, have more of a sense of ownership rather than be just throwing taxes into this government pool and then waiting for when they retire to take benefits out of that pool. You would have your own account instead. So some of the pros of that is that it might encourage more saving because people would see that these accounts building up over time. They would see that their own accounts are building up. It also might encourage more work because people wouldn't see the payroll tax so much as a tax, but just as an additional source of money that goes into their savings account. That is, because it's your account, you don't feel like it's being taken away from you, so you feel like you're getting to keep more of the money when you work. Another pro of the partial privatization was that it builds on the success of 401k plans. People are very happy with 401k plans. They feel like they've worked out well for them. Another pro was that he was going to have very limited investment options. People weren't allowed to sort of bet their entire retirement on a single stock. Instead, they had would have some low-risk funds to invest in. Another pro is that it ultimately reduces the reliance on the payroll tax, which is a regressive tax. That is, the taxes paid as a proportion of income, the taxes are actually higher for low-income workers than they are for high-income workers. That's because there's this cap on the payroll tax. After you reach a certain amount of income, you don't pay any payroll tax for that additional income at all. The theory being that those people aren't going to be receiving benefits based on those higher incomes either. But still, it's a regressive payroll tax, and reducing that, reliance on that would be better for low-income people. And in particular, there's this transition period. One of the characteristics of Social Security is it's hard to get a transition out of this current approach of paying for current benefits out of current taxpayers. Since it's not your money as a taxpayer, you're not building up anything for your own benefits. You're paying for your grandparents' benefits. There has to be a transition. That is, if you suddenly start taking money out of that fund that pays your grandparents and put it into your own savings account, then somebody has to pay for that transition because somebody still has to pay for your grandparents' benefits. And the way that the transition was going to work is that the government is going to have to borrow more money now to pay for current benefits, but in the future they wouldn't have to pay so much for your benefits because you're going to be getting more of your money from your own private account. So this transition is more likely to come out of increased income taxes down the road rather than increased payroll taxes. And in that sense, it would rely more on a progressive tax, that is, more on a tax that goes higher for higher income people and less on a regressive tax, less on the payroll tax, where the tax rate actually falls when income gets high. Okay, so those are some of the pros. Some of the cons are this transitional deficit certainly worries people. The fact that once you take some of today's workers' tax revenues and give it back to them as forced saving, then you have to find money from somewhere else to pay for today's benefits, and that's what's called the transitional deficit. And that certainly is it was a political problem and potentially an economic problem. Another con for private accounts is the risk of poor investment performance. There's a fear that if people invest themselves that they'll make mistakes or that the stock market will do funny things, and the result would be people would lose out in terms of retirement. Now, what President Bush tried to do to offset that was put up some kind of guarantee that people would receive at least as much as they would have under the old Social Security system. Whether that guarantee was, how that would guarantee would work was a little unclear. But anyway, that was his attempt at dealing with that. And another con with this partial privatization was just the intense opposition. I think a lot of Democrats didn't want to have anything pass, that major legislation pass, that Bush could present as a success. And there was very intense opposition from the AARP to any change in the system. So there was this kind of reflexive, intense opposition. There was a lot of division within the Republican Party over some of the issues. So you had a united Democratic Party opposed, and you had a Republican Party that was trying to feel its way toward a consensus within the party. but they certainly didn't achieve. Social Security reform is not the type of thing that you could pass by steamrolling over one party over and so it just there was never any mood for compromise, and maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Okay, in fact, I'll talk about that now, I guess, in terms of an alternative that was a potential compromise was so-called add-on accounts. The idea there is that you wouldn't do anything to the existing Social Security, but you would create an additional savings mechanism for individuals, and you would maybe come up with a mechanism that allowed workers who couldn't afford to save more to add to private accounts, give them some, some transfers to allow them to have accounts. So an add-on account would be a savings account that would look like one of these 401ks or look like a private Social Security account, but it would not come out of Social Security taxes. It would for high-income workers, it would come out of their own money, just like a 401k plan or an IRA would. And for low-income workers, it might come out of general tax revenues because they presumably they can't afford to save. So you would have the private accounts, but you would not do anything to affect Social Security. The reason that might have been a potential compromise is that from the Republicans' point of view, they would have been creating a precedent for private accounts that maybe eventually could be expanded to include Social Security. But from the Democrats' point of view, you would be, for the moment, leaving Social Security alone. So this compromise was proposed by a few Democratic economists. Never got any traction with either party politically. Okay, so that's on the sort of ownership society privatization half of things. The other issue is viability. You know, people talking about the fact that eventually the Social Security system as currently structured will run out of money and will either have to cut benefits or raise taxes. So and what what can you do about that? This is all out in the future. It's an imbalance between what we promised in the future and what we think we'll collect in taxes on Social Security in the future. That's what we're talking about. It's something that you have to worry about 30, 40 years from now. The reason to pay attention to it now is that you have to give people a fair chance to plan for retirement. If you wait until the last minute to see whether you have the money to pay for benefits and then tell somebody who's 62 years old, oh, looks like 5 years from now we won't have the money to pay your benefits, we're going to cut your benefits by 20%, that person has no time at all to adjust and raise their savings. They're just they just have to settle for being a lot poorer than they thought they would be. So you have to give people advance warning, and that's why you have to worry about the situation 20, 30 years down the road. And so what President Bush proposed to slow the growth rate of benefits in the future and to therefore achieve alignment between future benefits and future taxes was something called changing from wage indexing to price indexing. So what that means is that right now your benefits are calculated based on the last 5 years of your wages, of your Social Security wages. So and what the change would be that they would be based on your wages earlier, but with price indexing. That is, so instead of having your benefits keep up with your wages, benefits would simply keep up with inflation. And because your wages go up faster than inflation, the current system has benefits go up faster than something that would be indexed to prices. The difference between wage growth and inflation is productivity. I have the equation here, wage growth is equal to inflation, which is price growth, plus productivity growth. So, to the extent that there's productivity growth, wage growth is faster than inflation. If you index Social Security benefits only to inflation and not to wage growth, then any productivity growth is going to not be included, and so by doing this, you're slowing the growth rate of benefits. So this would slow the growth rate of benefits, particularly when productivity growth is high. And that's actually one thing that's a little bit odd about this approach to slowing benefits, is that, you know, if productivity growth is high, we might not need to slow the growth rate of benefits a lot. It's when productivity growth is in a lower range that we really need it. So in that sense, this is a bit odd. Of all the ways to slow the growth of benefits, this is a technical one that works. It may not be the most logical one, but it would work, and it does put us on a path of viability. That is, in which if you slowed the growth rate of benefits by linking them to prices and not wages, you do eliminate this sort of long run future deficit, the gap between what we've promised in the future to Social Security beneficiaries, you know, way out in the future, versus the taxes that we expect to collect for them. So that, you know, that's the sense in which we increase the viability of the Social Security system. We take the promises that we're making to today's young people and to the unborn, and we're lowering those promises in a way that makes it much more likely that we'll be able to keep those promises. Okay, so, you know, economists would have preferred to slow benefits in a different way by moving the retirement age up. Moving the retirement age up means that people would be working longer and not spending as much time as government dependents, because what's happening is that as people live longer and we keep the retirement age fixed, the proportion of someone's life that they spend as a beneficiary keeps getting higher and higher. And the idea of raising the retirement age and indexing it to longevity is to kind of keep the percentage of your life that you're a government dependent from continuously expanding. Now, the retirement age never was on the table politically, changing the retirement age. When Al Gore ran for president, he made a point during his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention that he would never tolerate raising the retirement age. The AARP in this year signaled very clearly that they would not tolerate an increase in the retirement age. Now, we're not talking about raising the retirement age for people who are now retired or who are close to retirement. We're talking about something out in the distant future. So the AARP is ready to say that, you know, if you're 30 years old today, we are not going to let you, we're going to protect you from the danger of having your retirement age move to 70 or 72. So the AARP views today's 30-year-olds and 35-year-olds as their constituency from that point of view. Whether today's 30 and 35-year-olds are being, whether their interests are really being protected by the AARP is rather questionable, but that's the way the AARP is operating. They want to make sure that you continue to have a retirement age in your 60s, regardless of what's going to happen in the future in terms of longevity and health and so on. One argument against raising the retirement age is that people, you know, who are engaged in physical labor. Al Gore used the example of a waitress. That was his example. But in fact, the proportion of the workforce engaged in physical labor is about 20% and falling. We still have, no one is suggesting changing the disability proportion, portion of Social Security, which certainly would cover people who are engaged in physical labor and who can't maintain their work because they're disabled. So you would keep the disability portion of Social Security, but you could still move the retirement age. And as the portion of people not engaged in physical labor keeps rising, the portion of people that might be affected, adversely affected by raising the retirement age, falls to a pretty low level. So you could, you, so I don't think that's a great argument against raising the retirement age, at least not for the vast majority of Americans. But in any case, neither the wage indexing proposal nor anything to do with retirement age passed. In fact, nothing passed this year. Other alternatives to deal with viability include trying to raise taxes now. The idea is you raise taxes and somehow have the government save that money to help pay for future benefits. That was essentially tried in the 1980s. Clearly, it didn't work. The problem is when the government raises taxes now, they turn around and spend the money. Sometimes they turn around and spend the money even if they don't raise taxes. So what we're going to see is somewhere down the road, benefit cuts or tax increases. That's the most likely outcome. Another outcome, which actually also may be likely, is what I call the pray for productivity solution. That is, if productivity growth is high enough, then we won't have to raise the tax rates. That is, people will be earning more. Because they're earning more, the taxes will be higher, and so the system will be viable because people will be earning so much that even at today's tax rates, we'll collect enough revenue to pay for things. But in general, if productivity is high, you don't have to worry about very much economically. But it's not a good idea to just plan for, that's like planning for winning the lottery. Not really the safest approach. The safest approach is to assume that productivity does not grow spectacularly, and then if it turns out it does grow spectacularly, you can afford to pay a lot in benefits. But the way I put it is that we should probably adjust the promises that we're making to today's 30-year-olds about their retirement, 30, 40, 50-year-olds. We should adjust those promises downward for a conservative estimate of productivity growth. And then if productivity growth is higher and we want to pay higher benefits down the road, that's fine. But right now, we're in a position where we can only pay the benefits that we promise if productivity growth accelerates. So we're betting on good luck on productivity right now. That's really where we stand. So we're in the pray for productivity situation. So in terms of the outlook, the political situation for any form of Social Security reform appears hopeless. All sorts of compromises were trotted out by economists this year, and they were all rejected. The political climate is very bad. One suggestion is that because one party controls all of government, that what that means is that the minority party is too bitter to compromise, and the majority party is too arrogant to compromise, and so you can't get any. And to get something like Social Security reform, you need a compromise. So we'll never get it. Social Security reform unless we get divided government. But even if we have divided government, I'm not convinced we would get reform. In terms of the economic outlook, productivity growth has been spectacular for more or less the past 10 years. And so that may be our best hope, is that we actually do get bailed out by high productivity. On the other hand, I think longevity may be increasing a lot faster than the forecasts that are embedded in the long-term projections for Social Security. So if longevity increases by a lot more, then without reforming Social Security, even though productivity increases, we may still run into problems. So I would certainly feel a lot better about Social Security if we had a retirement age that moved up along with longevity, because then that would take us out of the business of having to worry that increases in longevity will continue to unbalance the system. But I'm afraid we are in that situation now, where as longevity increases, the system comes more out of balance. And as long as that's true, it's hard to feel optimistic about the outlook for Social Security.